If you've ever played a sport, coached a team, or even tried to get small children into a car, you know the importance of a playbook, a plan, rules of attack. And sometimes, of course, those best-laid plans, well, they go out the window. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of August 15th, 2014. Our show this week is all about the playbook, when it works and when you got to make up a new one. When the rules seem to change on you midstream, requiring a total about-face. As always, we want to hear your thoughts on MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. So let's get started. Here's your Economic Week in 20 seconds.
General Motors issued five more recalls, including a recall of more than 200 Saturn View SUVs.
More job cuts coming at Cisco. The networking giant is laying off an additional 6,000 workers, or 8% of its workforce.
311,000 jobless claims were filed in the week ending August 9th.
We want to start with a story that shows how far from normal we still are. The standard playbook for an economic recovery often means you get the housing market going again. But in the U.S., it's still really patchy. Stops and starts, and it's a story about inequality and how much it can drag us down. Anjali Raval is a correspondent for the Financial Times, and her work caught our attention this week. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Lovely to be here.
I want you to start by describing some of these neighborhoods you visited in Sacramento, California.
Sacramento is one of the places that was hardest hit by the downturn that wiped out $7 trillion in homeowner equity. I traveled through a whole host of neighborhoods, and some of them in South Sacramento were, you know, incredibly sort of hard hit. And these are places that were targeted by investors in the last couple of years. Low-income suburban neighborhoods that were a bit run down, and that's where prices really dropped the most.
And when you contrast that with some of the other places you visited, say Austin, Texas, you got a totally different picture of what's happening in the U.S. housing market.
I really did. Austin was just, you know, one of these places that was just bustling with activity. People were very excited. Lots of young people moving there. Lots of job creation. People have got lots of money to spend. And that's what I thought was really striking, because it's so different from somewhere like Akron, which is also another place that I visited. Incredibly staid. And it just hasn't recovered at all, not just from the most recent financial crisis, but even the decades sort of prior to that, when they've seen lots and lots of job losses. And these things are all working their way into the housing market stories in each of these places. And they're all contributing to why the housing recovery is just so uneven across the U.S.
We talk a lot about inequality and a wealth gap in the U.S. And often that's spoken of as something that happens between people or across the income spectrum. But you seem to have displayed it as something that happens across and between cities. How does that seem to be holding back our recovery as a country?
Right. So we work with Trulia, the property website, to really just take a look at sort of the 100 most expensive metropolitan regions by house prices, and taking a look at the per capita income ratio between the 10th and the 90th most expensive. And now that ratio is at its widest since records began 45 years ago.
Wow.
So in this case, we're talking about the difference between Boston and Cincinnati. But this is just one way that housing markets are getting more and more different from one another. And this is sort of shaping the uneven housing recovery we're seeing, which is increasingly, you know, being dictated by jobs and incomes. These markets are playing out at vastly different speeds, because some sectors of the economy that are region specific, you know, such as technology in San Francisco, for example, they're really performing at different rates. And that's why you're starting to see some of the big regional differences too. And that's why the housing markets are obviously impacted by just how some of the sectors are performing.
Does that mean that we shouldn't talk about the U.S. as one economy or one housing economy or market then, and maybe lots of little ones? Or are we thinking too holistically?
Well, I think housing markets have always been different from one another. The question is now, are we getting to a place where we're locking some housing markets into sort of a downward spiral? I mean, that's the worry. The last thing you want to see is that the housing markets that perform the best keep on getting better, and those that are performing badly just keep on getting worse.
What's next for the US housing market then?
I mean, one concern that economists have raised is what happens when interest rates rise. We've already seen house prices really shoot up in a lot of places across the US. At the same time, wage growth really hasn't. So affordability in some pockets of the US is a problem. So what happens to regular buyers, you know, traditional buyers who economists have really waited to kind of come back into the housing market? I mean, they just haven't yet. So what happens then? You know, there's no doubt that the housing market has improved, but there is a concern that traditional home buying, you know, first-time home buyers are just not coming back.
Anjali Raval, correspondent for the Financial Times, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
We wanted to talk about some of the other economic issues out there. Plus, it's the weekend, so let's have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Cornerstone Tavern on 2nd Avenue in New York, and I am joined by Zach Bissonette, who's the author of Good Advice from Bad People, and Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. Hello to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hey.
I was in a bookstore this weekend, and there was an actual table that had a sign on it that said Hachette Books, you know, by this publisher who right now you cannot get their stuff on Kindle or on Amazon. These companies are ratcheting up this sort of internal marketing war and using almost these exclusionary practices as business, as marketing.
I think my sense from having followed it in the media is that Amazon thought that writers and sort of the public would put pressure on the publisher to go to Amazon and make a deal. That has not happened at all. I mean, I think 100% of people view Amazon as the villain in this.
I guess
thing.
It all comes down to the bottom line. And if they start to see that they're really losing money or investors lose confidence in them, that's probably a bigger deal than what you or I or someone who's shopping for books ends up thinking. Stacey, you play Candy Crush?
I am a recovering Candy Crushaholic, I guess. I had to delete the app from my phone. It's no longer on my phone.
But wait, they're like a real live big company now.
They went public. Yeah. Yeah, live is in dispute right now, maybe.
How do they make money?
So this is how they make money. It's called the freemium model, and this is
free, like a joining free and premium together?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Joining free and premium together, and this basically has taken over the entire app market. The way it works is that the app itself is free. You get to a certain level and you have to pay to continue. And by the time, I can tell you from experience, you are at the point where they ask you to pay to continue, you are just so gone. You are so hooked that the 99 cents seems like the lesser of two evils.
So like to get to level whatever.
I think it, from what I recall, it was level 35 to level 36. And I played level 35 for something like 5 weeks. And then I finally cracked.
Have you played this thing?
I have not. I actually have what I've heard about it, because the Kardashians have a similar app. Have you heard of this?
Where the Kardashian game.
The goal is to become like Kim Kardashian.
Well, and in fact, I think Candy Crush King Entertainment, which posted its earnings and its stock fell by something like 25%, and they blamed the Kardashian game. And in fact, I think what they said in their earnings call, the CEO was like, "Well, we shouldn't worry. Mobile gaming's still big. Look, everybody's signing up for the Kardashian game." They are no longer signing up for Candy Crush. However, this is still a viable business.
All right, Zach, I want to know, what is the one weirdest or most fascinating economic story you have been sucked in by this week?
The one that's been annoying me and actually led me into a Twitter battle against my better judgment is that every media outlet has been citing CelebrityNetWorth.com, with their estimate of Robin Williams' net worth being $50 million. There is no way to know the net worth of Robin Williams.
Why does it get you so worked up?
I think partly because it's bad journalism, and I think it's just sloppy and it's relying on an unreliable source. You have to keep in mind that you really don't know what anyone's financial life is like your friends, celebrities, anyone. This thing can look one way and be completely different. People are just way too credulous about believing figures about how people are doing financially when you don't know.
What about you, Stace? Any stories that really caught your eye this week?
It has to do with Axe body spray.
Yes.
So you know their ad campaign where the guy sprays Axe body spray on himself, and I mean, I think there was one where, like, women were in string bikinis, like, running through the jungle.
Desperate to get to him?
Yes. Well, these ads have worked like crazy. I mean, Axe totally dominates the body spray market. I'm sorry. This is coming back to Axe, and now they sort of feel, like, apparently vulnerable to being accused of false advertising. So they are changing their ad campaigns to be less of the sort of you will be a woman magnet. In fact, the tagline for Axe used to be, it will help you with women. But they are sort of backing off of that now, and they're changing their advertising tactic, which I kind of think is sweetly ethical. I also like that they've decided to do that instead of actually changing the way it smells.
I just love the idea that anyone, you know, would be concerned, you know, like with vetting the product claim that a $5 body spray, is it an aphrodisiac or isn't it? Like that would be like a serious, like, you know, well, our studies show that it might not actually cause all the women to just, you know, run to you.
Some poor 14-year-old kid in like Pittsburgh is like, you know, I think I might sue.
He should sue. He should sue them and Candy Crush.
Zach Bissonette, Stacey Vanek Smith, thank you to you both.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the world of college sports is in turmoil. We'll help you make sense of it.
You really have to part and parcel the sports themselves, revenue generating, non-revenue generating, basketball, football, almost everything else.
That's just ahead on Marketplace Weekend from APM. Brought you stories about immigration before on this show, and today we've got something a little different. Not a reporter telling a traditional story. We're throwing out those rules. This is a personal essay of sorts from our partners at the BBC and their correspondent in Mexico, Will Grant, about a group of women who help migrants heading north.
At the sound of the approaching train, a gaggle of student volunteers burst into action. It's coming, they yell, grabbing crates of semi-prepared bags of food and armfuls of water bottles before dashing towards the tracks. Not las patronas, though. They barely look up from their cooking. After almost 20 years of this work and countless false alarms, the women know the difference between the sound of a petrochemical transport train, on which migrants never travel, and the noise of la bestia, meaning the beast, the famous freight train which thunders through their tiny village every day. It is on the rooftops of this latter cargo train that scores of men, women and children make their thankless journey north to the United States. Este no es, that's not the one, says Julia Ramirez as she bags up portions of rice, one of a dozen or so local women to have dedicated their lives to this simple humanitarian task. Sure enough, 2 minutes later, the students re-emerge, sheepishly clutching the same crates and bottles of water, perhaps a little more aware that, when it comes to migrants, these largely uneducated women know a lot more than them. The story of how Las Patronas first emerged has been told so many times by the protagonists over the years that the exact characters and events have almost become interchangeable. Nevertheless, Norma Romero recounts the story of how, 19 years ago, she and her sister were standing at the side of the railroad tracks carrying their grocery bags. We were walking home with bread and milk for breakfast, Norma remembers, but the train came by and blocked our path. As we were waiting for it to pass, a group of people on one of the wagons shouted at us, "Madre, we're hungry," and then another group came by and the same thing, "Madre, we're hungry." so my sister threw them her bread and her carton of milk, and then I did the same. Arriving home empty-handed that morning, they expected to be punished for having given away the family breakfast. Instead, their mother, the indomitable Doña Leonida, encouraged them. The plan was to make 30 simple meals of corn tortillas, rice and beans, and throw them onto the train as it passed. The young girls had no idea that the people they'd helped were making their way to the United States in search of work. We always thought they were just adventurous Mexicans who were discovering our country by travelling for free, says Norma. Today, almost two decades later, those 30 daily meals have grown tenfold as the women cook for the thousands of migrants who flash past their village every week. In the process, their humble idea has become one of the most respected humanitarian organizations in Mexico, for which Las Patronas were awarded the country's top human rights prize last year. Standing on the banks of the railroad, I watch as the huge train rumbles past. The migrants, their arms outstretched, grab a potentially life-saving bag of food from Norma, Julia, and the other patronas. Patrona generally means boss or employer in Spanish, but the word has a religious connotation too, meaning patron saint. For the migrants, as they shout a grateful gracias before disappearing over the horizon, the name could hardly be more apt.
That's Will Grant, the BBC's Mexico correspondent. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. Today, we're going to try out an app that's part of the sharing economy. It's called Fiverr.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Mr. Five, tell us how you feel.
How do I feel? I feel alive!
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he's our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, so we're going to call up your friend and do something that's a little bit weird.
Yes, we're going to call up my friend, and I'm going to do a Dr. Claw impression. Do you remember the villain from the cartoon?
Yeah, from Inspector Gadget.
Inspector Gadget, exactly.
Inspector Gadget.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're going to call her. I advertised this service of basically doing someone's outgoing voicemail for them.
In the voice of Dr. Claw?
In the voice of Dr. Claw. And what we're going to do right now is we're going to call Anusha. I'm just going to check with her what she wants us to say. We'll record it here, and I'll also do it for her voicemail.
All right, let's get rolling.
This is Anusha.
Hi, Anusha. It's Ben, and I'm here with Lizzie O'Leary.
Hi,
Anusha.
Hi.
I really appreciate you being willing to pay for our service. We should say that this was unsolicited except via Twitter. We tweeted about this, and you very kindly offered to pay $5 for me to do this.
Yes, I did.
For right now, let's just agree on what you would like me to say.
Sure. Sounds good.
How about we do something where I say, you've reached Anusha's voicemail. Sorry you missed her. Next time, Gadget, next time.
That sounds good.
Okay.
You've reached Anusha's voicemail. You've missed her. She'll call you back. Next time, Gadget, next time.
That was pretty darn good.
Anusha, what was your experience like in terms of paying for this service? Have you heard of Fiverr before?
Yeah, I know people who have, like, put services on Fiverr, but I've never bought anything from them before. But it was super easy to do.
Okay, Anusha, well, listen, we're going to let you go now, but we will, you and I will meet up, and I will record this directly into your voicemail for
Sounds
you.
Sounds great.
Anusha, thank you very much for talking with us and hanging
thank
out.
Thank you.
All right, Ben, that was a great trip into my childhood briefly, but... Can you explain exactly why we just did that, why you did that Dr. Claw impression for Anusha's voicemail?
Okay, so it's sort of about the sharing economy, right? The idea that people can use technology to have direct transactions for goods and services, as Anusha described, right?
There are plenty... In this case, your cool character voice.
Yes, exactly. There are plenty of examples of this, right? Airbnb for vacation rentals, Lyft or for car rides. But there's also a growing number of web and mobile-based tools for a wide variety of services. Companies like TaskRabbit do this. There's a company
called... Oh, you know, I used a TaskRabbit. describe it, when I was moving, you know, I'm kind of a small person, and I paid a guy to help me move a great big box spring down the stairs because I couldn't lift it myself.
Exactly. And Fiverr is a very similar kind of tool and service and startup for this kind of thing. There's a growing number of services like this that basically try and connect you directly with people who can sort of help you do small things. And Fiverr is, you know, it takes its name from the amount that you would pay for something like this generally.
Okay, I have to be a little bit skeptical here, though. Is this really that big of an economic deal? Can this be a legitimate business model?
Well, just this week, Fiverr actually announced that they had another series of funding. This is what startups do all the time. They raise funds, and Fiverr actually raised $30 million in their most recent series. And it's added a bunch of more specific features for certain things that you can offer and ask for. So it's a little bit more than buddies just paying each other for a lark, right? People, and perhaps, I guess, most importantly, venture capitalists, think this kind of service, connecting people easy and simple ways, could deliver major dollar signs. The thing that's interesting about Fiverr is that it's sort of focused on these tiny little jobs, right? They cost a fiver, but they can go up to about $550 depending on the service. And that's not bad for maybe a week's of wages, right?
Some of the things that are on here are kind of silly, but some of them are very creative and tap into maybe second or sideline jobs that people have or skills that they couldn't figure out how to monetize otherwise.
Absolutely. Someone to proofread your resume if your mom won't do it. Somebody to do a voiceover for you. Someone to help you get more Twitter followers. There are all sorts of these sort of smaller tasks. But as it expands, you know, imagine finding someone to paint your house for you. Fiverr thinks that just like eBay and Amazon, a good design for reviewing people to pay and also to do the tasks at hand, if they build that, they can grow a user base and that'll lead to more services being offered.
One question I have is about how you kind of verify the people doing these tasks, whether they're any good at it, how you get to be comfortable with them. The services that are out there, do any of them kind of back up the people in their marketplaces?
This is a good question, and it's a tricky one to answer. I think it sort of depends on whether you're talking about Fiverr, TaskRabbit, et cetera, et cetera. Some of the services out there will sort of verify the skill set of the person who's offering their services. A lot of other ones don't. They leave it very simply, and they leave it up to you to decide, does this person look legit? Do they sound legit? Maybe they've posted a video about their service. You know, any number of things will help you make the decision, and then you get to rate them, and they get to rate you. So it's just kind of like Uber, right? You can sort of look at their rating and decide whether or not they seem legit after they've done a few things.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Lizzie.
For your own tech in real life, come check out the Marketplace app. You can find it in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. When we talk about throwing out the playbook, I mean it literally for this next story. It's about the NCAA. Sure, it's the organization behind college sports, but it's also a massive business, one that makes almost $1 billion a year in revenue through TV, video games, merchandising. All of that is up in the air right now. The NCAA just lost a huge court case that could start to undercut its ability to make money. More court cases are looming, and we wanted to put it all in context and find out what happens next. We went to Brooklyn to a studio where they specialize in animation and motion capture.
Steve Day, I'm the owner of Motion Capture NYC.
And what do you guys do here?
We motion capture all kinds of things, things for pharmaceutical industry, sports.
And some of those are video games?
And some of those are video games, yep.
Video games play a really important part in this story about the NCAA, and we'll explain more in a minute. But first, here's how motion capture works.
So motion capture is the movement of the character. It's somebody actually has to make that character move. And it costs a lot for an animator to do it by themselves. So instead, they just have somebody don a suit with a bunch of balls on it and do the character's motion.
So someone actually dresses up in a special suit.
Yep.
And then what happens?
Somebody dresses in a special suit and then they will do the motions of, in this case, in sports.
Running, throwing.
Scoring a touchdown.
How does that become a video game?
The way to think about it is like the human moving is moving a marionette or a puppet. And the balls that are on that black suit that people commonly see, that's where the strings would connect between the human and the puppet that they're moving in a 3D animated space. But the 3D character could be anybody. It could be your grandmother. It could be, in this case, popular sports figures.
So let's stop Steve Day right there. And imagine you go to play a video game, and all of a sudden you see yourself. Basically, your face is put on a motion capture animation. And the thing is, you didn't give anyone permission to use your face or make money off your face. And so you get mad and decide to sue.
Okay, well, that's exactly what happened in this case.
That's Bloomberg News sports business writer Scott Soschnick.
The lead litigant was Ed O'Bannon, who was an All-American basketball player at UCLA. One day after he had finished playing his basketball at UCLA, he was looking at a video game, an EA Sports video game, and lo and behold, he recognized himself and said, wait a minute, I never gave any permission for EA to use my likeness in this game. I'm sure they're selling lots of copies and making millions of dollars. So for him, there's nothing, because this was an injunctive case. So he actually forgave the ability to make money. But for players now, they will have the ability to negotiate some sort of rights fees should video game companies want to use their names and likenesses in any sort of offering.
So what did the judge say about the NCAA having to pay to use athletes' identities?
Well, in essence, what the judge said is that a lot of the components of what has been the cornerstone of the NCAA is illegal. It's a restraint of trade, that it's unfair for the NCAA to be making these piles of money, these billions of dollars in television revenue and video game revenue, and not sharing at least a part of it with the players. So that's one major component change. The second big change in this decision is that the full cost of scholarship will have to, full cost of attending school rather, will have to be increased to include more than just a scholarship, as well as a $5,000 trust fund per year for each athlete. So those are the major changes, a lot of which, by the way, had already been put in place by the NCAA when they gave sort of this autonomy to the Big Five conferences, the conferences that have the power, football teams and basketball teams, and make a big part of the revenue in all of college sports.
Do you think we're going to move toward a system where schools start actually paying student athletes?
Well, they've already talked about giving a stipend, so they're openly willing to do that. It's a question of what will the scope be. Yes, players will be getting money to attend, but how many? What are the implications with Title IX? If you give a male basketball player at a marquee program like Duke money, well, the law says you also have to give the female athlete, they have to get the same benefits. So what are the ramifications of all these decisions?
You talk to a lot of college players. Do they think of themselves as amateurs?
It depends on which sport. You really have to separate part and parcel which athletes we're talking about. It's impossible for a swimmer, let's say, to feel like a professional athlete because he's not on ESPN every Monday. He's not a household name. The jersey or shirt, whatever it may be, is not hanging in the campus bookstore. Now, if you're talking about the star quarterback at Notre Dame, he has to do media obligations every day. His jersey is hanging in the bookstore. He's on TV every weekend. People around the globe know his name, know his stats. He's probably a target on Twitter from opposing fans. I mean, that sounds like a professional atmosphere to me. So you really have to part and parcel the sports themselves, revenue generating, non-revenue generating, basketball, football, almost everything else, and then even the level of player. The superstars at the highest levels of these sports are more well-known or just as well-known as any professional athlete out there.
Scott Soschnick, reporter for Bloomberg Sports, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
And that brings us to the weekend number. As in 30 days. That's how long the NCAA has asked the same federal judge to delay another suit, similar to the one they just lost. The head of the NCAA says they will also appeal parts of the O'Bannon suit, although they haven't specifically said which ones. Coming up on Marketplace Weekend, a story about money and rock and roll.
We were pretty far in the red at the end of last year because we'd pretty much sunk everything into the music, as well as getting hit with 2012 taxes in the middle of producing the album. And we were just like, oh, we forgot about that.
Rock band Future Islands and their relationship with the almighty dollar. Stick around. Care Act changed the playbook for how a lot of us interact with the healthcare system. Health exchanges officially opened their doors at the beginning of this year. We thought it was a good time for a checkup, to hear about your experiences. We've been collecting them on MarketplaceWeekend.org and on Twitter. Chad Terhune, a healthcare reporter for the LA Times, is here to talk through how the health law affects your finances. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been collecting stories from our listeners, from people online, and I want to play some of those for you, just little snippets, so that we can hear different people's experiences and then talk about some of the issues that they raise. I want to start with Peter, who was in his 60s, and he had stayed at his job previously because it gave him health insurance. Let's listen to his story.
My name is Pete, and I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. And this is my experience with the ACA. I was working in a job that was physically strenuous for me. I was working a night shift, and I was sometimes having to restrain people who were intoxicated. This sometimes involves a grappling match or a wrestling match. Although it didn't happen very often, I found that I was getting exhausted because I have congestive heart failure. So it was a job I was really no longer fit to do. However, I had to keep the job because I was getting my insurance through my employer. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, I was able to buy my own insurance, and this made it possible for me financially to leave the job behind. Now, I was 63, which means that I was too young for Medicare. Right now, I'm paying $448 a month. And believe me, I get my money's worth out of health insurance.
Chad, I'm curious, when you listen to Pete's story, sticking with a job for health insurance is something that a lot of people did prior to the ACA. Has that made an appreciable difference, do you think?
That was a very common story, that job lock. People need to be reminded that the individual insurance market was not a very welcoming place before the Affordable Care Act, and someone like Pete, who was 63, had congestive heart failure, he would have been unable to buy a policy on the open market from most insurers, because remember, they could exclude you for pre-existing medical conditions. Even if you just had an allergy or a prescription for a certain drug, they wouldn't even offer you a policy, and that was legal. So this really is a dramatic change for someone like that, no questions asked, to get a health insurance policy on the open market. Certainly many people have left coverage that maybe was very expensive. They had no other choices. And now, yes, they can go into these government-run exchanges and buy a policy. I think in terms of how many people have done that, it often becomes a financial equation. Workplace insurance generally will still be a better deal because you're getting that contribution from your employer. So in Pete's case, he's only paying $448 a month. That's a good deal for a 63-year-old. And like he says, he's got a lot of medical conditions. But for some people, even staying at work will still be a better deal.
I want to talk about some of the flip side of this, which is, you know, some of the plans that we have seen under the ACA come with high out-of-pocket costs or high deductibles. I want to play some sound from a listener named Brian. He and his family were buying on the individual market before the ACA, and they switched to an ACA plan, and it didn't entirely meet their expectations. I want to listen to that.
Hi, I'm Brian. I live in Mahomet, Illinois, and I teach junior high math for a living. Last year, before the ACA, my wife, daughter, and I were all on individual plans. When it started up, rates for me went way up, so I went back on my employer's plan. My wife and daughter got a Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Illinois, silver plan with a high deductible. And then this year, my daughter has had a minor surgery. My wife has had some moles removed. And a significant amount of that is not covered at all. It's just straight to the deductible. We kind of assumed it would be. I mean, it's been both good that we don't have to worry about if she were to get pregnant, we wouldn't go broke for medical bills. But it's been frustrating in the thousands of dollars we've had to pay for basically what we think are routine surgeries.
In terms of how comprehensive the plans are, what are you seeing?
On health insurance, I mean, the original kind of main goal is to protect you, as he said, as Brian said, to keep from going broke by medical bills, kind of that catastrophic coverage. If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, I will have health insurance if I'm in the hospital for weeks or even months. Now, that next step, what he's talking about of when you go in for a minor surgery, if you have this procedure, that procedure, on these plans, on Obamacare, you will pay a fair amount out of pocket before your insurance will kick in fully. And of course, there's a range of plans.
What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, it's a trade-off. If you have more first dollar coverage, if it kicks in right away, if you just have to pay $50, you're going to have to pay a higher premium. And that's what the insurance company is going to say, because they're going to look at this and say, how much cost do I have to pick up?
There have also been some changes to what employers are doing. And this gets to a kind of a thorny question about how the Affordable Care Act has changed the behavior of companies and of employers. I want to play some sound from our third person, Mark, whose employer essentially changed what they offered because of the Affordable Care Act.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm from Orlando, Florida. And here's how the Affordable Care Act has affected me. So this year, my employer changed our plan, the employer-sponsored plan that we have at work, for everyone to now be on a high deductible health plan. So the big change is that no more co-pays. I'd be interested in hearing a full explanation on why employers right now are moving to a high deductible health care plan.
So what's the reasoning behind that? Why does an employer move toward a high deductible plan? And I guess let's put high deductible plan in plain English for everybody.
Yeah, no, this is a very good topic. This is a lot of confusion surrounding this. So a high deductible plan generally would be a plan, say, with a $3,000 deductible. The average deductible now for a family on a PPO, which is a very common type of health policy, would be closer to $1,000. So many people at big employers would have a $1,000 annual deductible. When we say a high deductible, we're talking three times that, maybe $3,000. Sometimes it can even be a little higher. I think the major point now is people are going to start to get all the notices at work and say, here are your new health plans in the workplace, and we've had to make these changes. And many are going to cite the Affordable Care Act. And I think many experts will tell you many of these changes were already in the works. They're really not driven so much by the Affordable Care Act.
Hmm.
And there was actually a survey this week where it talked about nearly a third of large employers will offer only high deductible plans to their workers.
If you're a consumer and you're thinking, okay, what's in store for me next year? What should you be watching for? What's coming next?
Price matters most to consumers, and the early signs on premiums are fairly encouraging. So we've had some evidence in California. The average increase for Obamacare policies for individuals will be 4% on average. In many other states, is in the neighborhood of 8%. There are exceptions in Florida. A big Blue Cross carrier wants to raise rates nearly 18%. So some people will be socked with some double-digit increases. It all depends on where you live, what health plan you have. Now, the good news is, as we talked about earlier, it's easier to shop around, to pick a new policy. And some people say, well, 8% doesn't sound very good. But actually, in health insurance, that's fairly good because double digits have been the norm. And we've even had some insurance companies, get ready for this, have decreased their health insurance premiums. That did not happen in the individual market before. So we're seeing some impact of competition. Insurers are battling for new members.
Chad Terhune, healthcare reporter for the LA Times, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For next week, education budgets are tight. We want to know how you or your family help your school make ends meet. Tell us your stories at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. On this show, we sometimes talk about asking a financial planner for help. That playbook can get a little murky, though, when the rules aren't clear. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson did a story this week about how to watch your own back and stay safe, and a lot of you were interested in it, so we brought her back to talk about it. Hi, Tracy.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Recap your story for us. You were talking about when a financial planner makes sense. And sometimes there can be some real pitfalls here.
Normally having a professional look at your finances is a good thing. We could all benefit from a little help in this area, and this is something you talk about all the time. And normally we expect those advisors to act in our best interest. My story this week was about a couple loopholes, especially when it comes to retirement planning, where that standard doesn't necessarily apply for the financial advisor. And it can be really tough to know whether you're dealing with someone who is looking out for your best interest or whether you're dealing with someone who is more of a salesperson.
You had a man in your story who was sold an annuity. Tell me about him, sort of what he thought he was buying and then what he ended up getting sold, I guess is a good way to put it.
William Percy was retiring in the late 90s from Pacific Bell. He was a phone line installer. He met this advisor through the company and thought that because he met her through the company that she had been vetted and he could trust her. So she sold him this product, and it turned out it wasn't as safe as she had maybe represented it to be. And when the market turned, it had a significant fees, the principal shrank, and it just wasn't a great deal for him in the end.
And she got paid every time she sold one of these things to somebody, right?
Exactly.
A lot of people, I think, maybe are scared of numbers. They feel like they ought to trust a professional. Why aren't all of these advisors required to act in our best interest?
So it is something that the Department of Labor and possibly also the SEC are looking into right now, to making this a requirement for everyone who works in this area. And like I said, it is a requirement for some people in this area. There are just certain situations where right now you're not covered.
So if they're called a fiduciary, for example, they have to act in your best interest.
Exactly. So when it comes to retirement planning, the law on the books is a 1970s law, and it's really meant for pensions. That was the standard way that people saved for retirement at the time. And so what the Department of Labor now is looking to do is to shift, modify, update these laws so that they do cover a broader range of the way people save these days.
When you were reporting this story, was there anything that surprised you when you were looking at this and you thought, wow, I didn't expect this to be this way?
You know, I thought a simple disclosure would solve the problem if people were required to say, you know, these are, I'm being paid to sell you this product, that might be a solution. I actually talked to Barbara Roper with the Consumer Federation of America, and she told me that there are some studies that suggest that when people do disclose information like that, it actually builds trust.
Wow, that's fascinating. So if I say, listen, hey, Tracy, I'm selling you this thing, but, you know, by the way, I'm selling you this thing.
Right, I want to disclose my interests. I do get paid. This is a situation where I could benefit from selling you this product. It might not be a solution for everyone.
That's fascinating. What are you working on next? Peek into your notebook. Tell us what else is coming down the pike for you.
Well, Lizzie, next week I will be going to Atlantic City, and I will be looking at Atlantic City's roots as a resort community and where it is today, which is very heavily dominant on casinos and casino revenue. It's been having some struggles recently, so I will be looking into that.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Everybody has one, a moment or a story when money changes your life. This week, a band makes it to the big stage, but has trouble letting go of their DIY improvised playbook.
Hey, this is William Cashin.
This is Sam Herring.
And this is Garrett Wilmers.
And we're Future Islands.
I think a big turning point was when we got picked up by a booking agent. That was the first kind of just allegiance in the music industry. We always felt like we were kind of on the outside. We know I booked our shows for about 7 years, and we all just did everything, like, for especially the first like 5 or 6 years, we were, you know, going to Kinko's, making black and white just Xerox copies and cutting them out in the van and burning CDRs. But as soon as we brought on a booking agent, it was like somebody waved a magic wand, and we were just getting like guarantees everywhere we went, which wasn't a lot of money, but it was like a door deal. It was like a prearranged amount of what we would get paid, which is just totally changed the game for us as far as just the kind of money that we were making.
We were pretty far in the red at the end of last year because we pretty much sunk everything into the music, as well as getting hit with 2012 taxes in the middle of producing the album. And we were just like, oh, we forgot about that. We got hit really hard with taxes last year. Our accountant called us in one day, and he's basically like, well, first off, you know, you guys have very high taxes because you made a lot of money last year, a lot more than I expected. Because you're an LLC, you're in the highest tax bracket. And I was kind of looking at the guys like, so should we high five? Is that, like, we made it in the highest tax bracket. And we got destroyed. We got destroyed by the U.S. government. Maybe they'll come after us.
They beat us up and they handed us our wallets. Because we did it ourselves for so long, we figured out how to do it very frugally. We just sort of took all the roles upon ourselves and cut corners everywhere that we could along the way.
Well, that's because we had to. We've just always done things. We've always worked solely out of necessity with what we could do. And I think that's one of the reasons we've survived. It's funny because now we're at the point where we're realizing we do need these certain crew members. And we're I'm furiously shaking my head no. Like, I don't want to do that. But even though it is time to give the reins over, because it's just too much for us now.
We're still super hands-on with everything, but I think because it's our baby.
My problem is that I don't need anything, and I expect a lot. It's kind of like, if you're going to be paid for your service, then you've got to do your job. But also, I don't need your help. The same. Does that make any sense? Because I mean that's the reason I do what I do, is because I don't need any overhead. I don't want any any hard direction in things like that, because you know that's why I'm an artist, is so I can do what I want to do, basically.
That was the band Future Islands. Their latest album is Singles. They're touring the U.S. this summer and fall. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next time, we'll have some brunch and talk about how you help get classrooms ready for the school year. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Jenny Ament, and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ravi Karman is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you next weekend. This is APM.